On this week's show, Connecting Models Early Leads to Better Engineering with Michael Gustafson from QNECT. In this week's news, is gray work killing your productivity? And more.
Construction is the world's oldest industry but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, Nathan, it feels like I just saw you yesterday. Nice t-shirt, by the way.
I think I'm hiding the trophy. I realized, there it is. Yeah. Got to move the microphone so you can see the trophy there. Congratulations, by the way. Yeah.
Yes. The annual AEC Integration Summit 2024 Pickleball Tournament. Winner, chicken dinner. Although we won't harp on it because, it is a bad look when the organizers win the tournament. We may have, but it was last minute. We weren't even going to play,
Chad Pearson won it as team lead, so technically.
Yeah, that's right. It goes with the Plexus Patriot. You're going to have to hang it on that Plexus.
Exactly.
That Plexus Patriot right there. Awesome. Well, we're not alone. Michael, how are you this morning?
I am awesome. It's great to be here, gentlemen.
It's good to have you. We're coming off a good event. Where are you coming to us from this morning?
So I'm based in Atlanta. So I'm out of my home office here. In Atlanta. So yeah, happy to be here. It's
hot Atlanta. It's that time of year. I was just talking to Rob McKinney and we had Josh Bone with us, who I'm sure with your days and your past, Michael, you know Josh well.
Yeah. So, and yeah, I've been based down here for a number of years. My background, I practiced as a structural engineer many years and then moved to Trimble down here in Atlanta several years ago. Their main office for Tekla is based down here, but been working down here, engaged with Autodesk for a number of years, leading strategy there, and now with QNECT, but based down here in the Southeast.
Yeah, so you've had a nice run through the evolution of construction tech. We were talking about it before, time at Tekla and time at Autodesk and now at QNECT. So, I mean, why, obviously you're an engineer, so, that's probably why you got started, but why jump into the technology side of things? Why chase that, hamster wheel, so to speak?
Yeah, no, it was interesting. I mean, I think like a lot of, whether engineers or contractors who move into technology, they had an experience as in their work and like, gosh, there's got to be a better place or better solutions to do this, right? And I had an opportunity to work on some really cool projects when I was at L.R.B. Beckett and, engaging with the steel suppliers, like the fabricators, and learning about how important, the steel connections are to projects are, really exposed my eyes. At the firm I worked at, there was a lot of engineers, like they come from the old school where engineers actually do the connection design. That was just what you do. Guys who worked at Bethlehem Steel, Havens, and these types of places. So I really cut my teeth learning how engineers design and kind of set my course to be like, okay, and getting into the technology sector to really make those processes of design better.
That's an interesting one because we don't talk a lot about steel on the show. It's interesting because I don't know, and Nathan's laughing over there. There's probably some reason that's out of my purview as to why we don't talk enough about it. But it feels overlooked, yet it is like structurally one of the most important parts of what we do. I mean, maybe foundation and steel, right, Nathan?
Well, I mean, real quick background, because just last week, Chad Pearson was leading the Dude, Where's My Fab? And originally, Luke Faulkner, who, Michael, I know you know very well, with AISC, all of my experience, and again, Michael, why we go back, was the Tekla days of structural steel and these conversations of who details it, who fabricates it, who engineers it. There's all these kind of broken pieces, but I think it had gotten, more or less figured out. with BIM in kind of that again, late 2000s, early 2010s. But now we bring in all of this light gauge, and we've been talking more about panelization. We had the Blue Vera guys on in this conversation of, okay, how does detailing change? How does engineering change? How does fabrication change? And I'm like, guys, somebody else has already figured out some of this stuff. And I have a lot more questions about QNECT and kind of what you guys are doing within that structural steel world, but then kind of looking at it with that lens of what are the other offsite fabricated, either MEP or panelized light gauge walls or other things like that, that this sort of a solution could potentially be applied to.
Yeah, no. And I think things are becoming more multidiscipline, that view. I mean, steel, it was a good, where I'm focused now at QNECT, but we're talking about that narrative of, other systems. When I worked at, all those years at TechOne, Autodesk too, you learn about other parts of the world, right? And structural engineers in other parts of the world do, they do the design and detailing for concrete, rebar, precast, timber, steel, right? I mean, the U.S., okay, West Coast, the engineers do connection design, right? But so there's these different workflows, but we can learn from the rest of the world too. Like, okay, why are they doing it the way they're doing it? And things, the trends of like prefabrication, you're right, that's continuing to ramp up. And that requires, right, more of this multi-trade coordination, thinking of design holistically. And so I think that trend is driving that direction.
So on that note, are you guys having more traction in Europe or US, or kind of where are you getting a foothold?
Yeah. So, I mean, QNECT, we're focused on the US market right now. I mean, so to set the stage, yeah, QNECT is a managed service provider. We provide both software and services for optimizing steel designs. And our, roots come from working with fabricators to, remove inefficiencies and material and process waste. I've been shifting more upstream to engineers, but been focused on the U.S. market. But it is interesting because a lot of engineering firms are global, right? And a lot of consolidation happening in the industry. So we're getting, requests about that. And my background too, because I've been exposed to a lot of global engineering companies, I think, there are, we have our eyes on looking at different parts of the market in that sense. I mean, I think the U.S. is an interesting market, right? Because it's the biggest construction market, right? So one building code, 20% of the global construction or whatever the number is these days. But yeah, I think there's opportunities in other parts of the world.
Yeah. So give people, I like that too. You're providing two different things. You're providing software and services. So we call that in our world, eating your own dog food. So, yeah. You're not only selling the software, you're using it yourselves. And some things, I mean, I learned this in my days with Join, is like steel is a lot prefabricated. Like they're way ahead of us on that just because they have to be, but there is like timing too. Like I had no idea about a roll of steel and when the roll occurs and having to be ahead of it and making a decision before it. So I'm kind of interested to peel back the onion here. What is at its core QNECT? And you're not new, right? You've been around for a while. So talk about the journey to how you got to here, and then maybe we can talk about where we can take it.
Yeah. So, I mean, QNECT has been around, a bit over a decade, and its founders really were looking at how to make the steel design to construction process more efficient. Yes, the industry has been doing prefabrication, but there's always been that disconnect of when does that prefabrication start? The analogy that, we talk about is like, would you go do have a surgery done on your hip or your knee without doing an x-ray or MRI, right? Would you just go in directly to the surgery, right? And that's the analogy, is that's how the U.S. structural engineers work today, right? They go into that surgery when the project's delivered without doing the MRI. And so that prefabrication doesn't happen until the bid is awarded to the fabricators. And so, but what we see is what, again, the Europeans are doing is they do the MRI up front. They actually uncover all the risks, uncover all the complexities as part of their structural design deliverables. And so, and then that's actually what the fabricators bid on which reduces the uncertainty and also speeds up the project delivery. So Connect is really is automating that delivery process through cloud engineering software that, you know, which 20 years ago, it was all very manual, you know, based. You're using, of course, 3D modeling software, but our cloud engineering is automating like the calculations and the modeling to, you know, 80% of the model as much as possible. And so that's where it's like many trends in the industry, it can take decades for a new trend to be embraced. Technology can be part of that solution to have that adoption happen.
Construction in general is a highly stressful environment, and you see the stress and you always get the "I'm fine" answer, but always try to dig a little deeper because people say, you know, I haven't been sleeping great and I'm really eating crappy food and I feel anxious. I feel depressed. I feel, you know, we'll start to really get into those conversations and figure out what's going on. There's some great resources. And if you go to brentdarnell.com/resources, first, there's an emotional intelligence and physical symptom survey test. So we get your emotional profile and we get your physical profile based on physical symptoms, and we tell how your body's working. And then we can correlate those two. And if burnout, if you're experiencing burnout, it will show up in probably both of those evaluations. It's free. You just download it and do it. And just so see where you are. And if you have burnouts, the top two or three that pop up and show up there, I would pay attention and start to really look at what are you doing with stress and nutrition and sleep and exercise and daily reflection and those kinds of things that we know we need to do to keep us healthy and keep us sane and keep us on track.
You've got to check in with where you are. You've got to work on balancing. It's not about the diagnosis. It's about preventing people from getting too far down the road. Like most of our construction folks that listen in, they take care of their cars. They keep them up to date. You know, this is no different. You've got to put in the maintenance on the body, on the mind, because you're racing this car around the track, right? We're not going to change that we're a bunch of race cars out there, but we can change that we do the right maintenance, take the right time, and really check in.
One more resource in there, the Tough Guy Survival Kit, guy being gender neutral. It's specifically written geared toward more field folks, but there's a really great chapter on stress management and peak performance in there, and it talks about meditation techniques and mindfulness techniques and breathing techniques.
Yeah, I like that answer. I'm going to toss it to you, Nathan, but that's that old, it takes a really long time to be an overnight success in this business. So it's that time. So what I'm sure this is more up your alley, Nathan.
Yeah, I mean, I love how you're connecting all these different players here, general contractor, estimator, engineer, fabricator. But the detailer one, it sounds like, what services, or I guess, how do you help the detailer versus are you replacing the detailer? Like, yeah, like help me understand what is kind of the future role for the detailer.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the short term, there's, you know, of course, the detailers are a huge critical part of the, you know, connecting that design to the detailing. We, you know, the companies who are using our software, you know, if it's an engineering firm, they have in-house detailers, right? Or if we're delivering our managed services of an early connected model, we work with detailers that use our software, right? So, but it's a human and machine interaction, right? We can amplify the human to increase productivity by automating as much of the simple repetitive tasks, freeing up their time to spend on the complex. So that narrative that's a very strong narrative these days, like in the AI space. I mean, that continues. That's a good analogy to use of how we're helping detailers and also connection engineers.
Actually, maybe that's a good segue because I was doing some LinkedIn stalking and noticed, I think you're a certified AI professional or help me understand more about, yeah, like kind of the AI role you're playing in all this.
Yeah, I mean, I saw the trend, yeah, a number of years ago. I mean, of course, it's been around for many years, but I saw the writing on the wall happening. And so MIT just had a course on for business managers. So it's more about how do companies, you know, embrace AI and adapt to the changes happening. I think I'm just as surprised as everybody, though, how it's like really kind of had a hockey stick in the last year or two. But, you know, and I think, you know, everybody's going to have to get on, you know, understanding what the impact is going to be for their business. It is a Gutenberg moment from my perspective. And it's changing every parts of a business, from marketing to sales to, you know, operations. Yeah, across the board.
Yeah, I love that point that it's not just about buying the AI; it's actually understanding and having, you know, that certification of, you know, how do you use it appropriately, right? Like it, just like having a driver's license or anything else, right? Like we have to be trained on this stuff.
We're still in the beginning curves of a kind of a new wave of adoption. I think there'll be a trough of disillusionment, you know, where things will kind of drop down with expectations, and then it'll recover again over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. But I think we're going to all learn and learn from our mistakes, and the industry will adapt. Cool. So
yeah, I think you're right. It's going to adapt because we're augmenting one another. Again, it's a matter of, I was just thinking, this is where I remembered it. It was the Construction Brothers. Those guys get a lot of the detailing stuff and a lot of the steel fabrication discussions. And we don't have enough steel detailers. Steel detailers are just trying to go, 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 go. They're at capacity. They're not thinking straight. You know, and a lot of them are stressed out and overworked. So if we can do a lot of what you're talking about, not only just with Qnect right now and then AI as it learns and the data that you're giving it over the future, we can give them superpowers. So maybe they can do quality work in 40 hours and go home, and we can stop a lot of the burnout that we experience in that world. So I'm interested too. Not enough people are looking at AI from a business perspective. They're looking at it from a hype perspective. Like, I think if you're looking at this from a hype and an investment perspective, you're like, I want to, you know, I'm going to put all my chips in the middle. But I think the business perspective is, I think I'm just going to meet the ante right now, right? So
yeah,
I'm interested in how Qnect is kind of watching that from a strategy perspective.
Yeah, no, I think it fits into, you know, where we see the investments happening around AI and you know, like with our services, a managed services for early connected models, there what you're trying to do is de-risk the project through the timing of when, you know, how you deliver services, right? It's working with the detailers, moving their connected model services upstream and solving kind of the big rocks, right? And I think that's what AI, you know, can be doing as well, is, you know, not trying to do everything at the same time, but prioritizing based on whether it's high risk areas or it's based on, you know, how other types of ROI and how you measure that. Like high risk, the analogies of, you know, AI being applied in diagnostics, again, interesting with, you know, the pattern recognition that AI can do, right? So doctors have been able to leverage that benefits of AI due to the image processing capabilities. And that's de-risking. That's a risk, you know, de-risking in the medical field, right? So I see similar things with, you know, Autodesk has been investing for years in that space, you know, construction site and identifying risk areas, with supply chain members, right, with Construction IQ, or, you know, it's risk identification and mitigation. That seems like a natural application with AI.
Well, and it makes perfect sense why you'd be wanting to move upstream to that engineering perspective, because, you know, ultimately their system that they're creating, you know, if that's a fragmented, you know, kind of just bunch of one-off calculations, it's gonna be a lot harder for you to, you know, do any sort of pattern recognition or AI kind of off of that when you get into more of the detailing side of things. And so I think, yeah, it's the more you're able to connect further upstream. I mean, shoot, Jeff, how many episodes do we talk about DFMA, design for manufacturing assembly? You know, like this is the closest, you know, to really trying to get to that, but it takes getting to the engineers to get them to design in a way that allows your detailers to be more efficient and everybody else downstream from that.
Yeah. Yeah. And with, you know, what you're talking there too about is having multiple expert systems working together, like with DFMA, and having machines, whether it's AI or different automotive or automated solutions that are maybe not AI, but they're automation, to be able to allow those expert systems to work more efficiently. It does require more collaboration by team members, right? They need time to collaborate. They're solving those problems early. If you can use the automation, the AI in the background to automate all the simple tasks that frees up that time for that collaboration that they need to do up front.
So here's a question. So on that whole kind of moving upstream and trying to connect all these different, you know, supply chain stakeholders, are there any industries that stick out that you're having more success than others in connecting the detailers and the fabricators and the contractors and engineers?
Yeah, well, I think speed is driving it. So any industries like where speed is important, right? And so recently, I mean, naturally, data centers, of course, are booming because of the appetite for the hunger for cloud compute, AI, you know, and AI is very cloud mm-hmm. compute intensive, right? So, but no, we're hearing it from data center owners who are just, you know, there's this pressure to build core and shells, right, and find tenants and that. And so speed is driving that need for that collaboration up front, because they can, you know, what you're doing is you're parallel processing the work process, right? The normal traditional, you know, engineer, you're handing it off to the fabricators who then hire the detailers. Waterfall. It's a very linear process. Now you're bringing things up front, you're parallel processing. Of course, it's a natural, it makes sense naturally that you're mitigating, you know, you're accelerating schedule. What it also does is though that you're eliminating all the inefficiencies of RFIs. You know, you mentioned like the Construction Brothers podcast, and you listen to a lot of those podcasts or just other detailing posts. They complain about RFIs and how, you know, they respond to RFIs and how that just slows down the whole process. Well, if they are able to work early alongside the engineers, which is this early connected model process, you're just eliminating those RFIs up front. And then it makes the whole backside so much smoother. So the industry is just more efficient. It can deliver projects faster. So it makes total sense. But data centers, and we're kind of top of mind when you ask that question.
Yeah, it's really funny. The irony is not lost on us. Oh, I don't know. I think this AI thing's a fad. Can you build me another data center tomorrow? It's like, you guys do realize those two things are going together. So it's going to get, I think it's going to be a fad. One more data center, please. But I think you're right, right? Those early RFIs too. We just discussed this on a recent episode last week about, you know, the earlier they're raised too, they don't contain as much risk or as much cost at the earliest stages. And if you're really in what our guests call deep collaboration, which I love, that I'm getting all these new terms, and deep collaboration's one I really like, because it's beyond the superficial contractual relationship. It's really getting involved in the process and this, you know, making this linear thing work. So it's really cool to see that earlier process de-risk. I'm wondering what some of the other benefits of, you know, just moving this to the front are for customers and ultimately, right, for owners.
Yeah. So, RFIs, you know, are kind of a stepping stone, but the cascading impact, of course, schedule, which we talked about, but also cost, you know, the cost of, you know, better certainty, you know, like cost goes down with the bids because of the certainty. Any trade contractor, whether it's a steel fabricator or a concrete, you know, a rebar supplier or whoever, they're going to build in uncertainty into their bids, especially if the drawings aren't complete, right? And if they anticipate issues, right? And also mm-hmm. just the level of detail that's provided, the lack of detail that's in the design. So if you can increase the fidelity of the data, you can eliminate the RFIs and improve the certainty. It lowers the cost. And another benefit that, I mean, owners who care about sustainability are thinking about carbon, right? And mm-hmm. you can think, well, materials like steel, I mean, it's highly recyclable, yes, but there's still energy that's used to produce the steel, you know, even recycled steel, right? So steel and, you know, concrete, these materials have a big impact on, you know, embodied carbon. We know embodied carbon is a big contributor to global warming. So I think owners, like, you know, even data center owners, back to data center, or most commercial owners now in, you know, New York, Boston, California, there's a lot of markets where they have sustainability goals. They're caring about that reducing carbon narrative. And so that is an area that we continue to invest in too. So not just with the early connected models process, but even on equipping engineers to think about how do they reduce carbon on their designs kind of in the context of cost, right? Because sometimes they actually conflict with each other, which is interesting, right? But owners are asking for both, right? So the design teams have to kind of, you know, show their design evolution with that context of both carbon and cost.
And validating it. Nathan and I had an interesting experience recently with owners where we were discussing that, and it was highly visible to us that like that it used to be the cost and, you know, carbon, like we care about carbon, but honestly, if you ask us, it's cost, right? Because not for any other reason than that's how they're judged. Well, they're seeing their assets judged differently now. And so they're adjusting that. I think there's a tipping point where it's going to be like, all right, my carbon footprint is more important to me because my assets' long-term value is going to be driven by its embodied carbon, its ESG. Those things are going to outweigh cost. And man, you got to have a tool like yours to measure that, right? If we can't measure it, we're just kind of, I don't know, maybe, you know. So this is an opportunity for you guys to help with the visibility of that choice itself and then present it to owners to make some, you know, well-informed decisions.
Yeah. And the process, I totally agree with you. And that process is, you know, continuous throughout the process. The design process, right? In the early design stages, I know there's good carbon calculation tools on the market to look at it. But, you know, hearing from, you know, leaders in the industry, like Don Davies, who was, you know, formerly with MK Magnussen Clemensic, talked about, you know, measuring it at stages and how key it is to measure it when the manufacturers are brought on board, because you need to hold them accountable to what the design definitions were. And so you have to really track it throughout the project. And that's really key. And we're seeing that as that's going to be important for how we're developing these tools. It's got to be trackable throughout the whole life cycle.
Man, I mean, we could have a whole episode just on like even just residential rebates and like energy rebates. And is it coming from the city? Is it coming from your energy authority? Is it coming from, you know, the direct? Because, and they have ones where it's directly from the licensed installer that is the one actually claiming for that rebate and has to provide those savings directly to the consumer up front and wait for those checks to come in later. And all those things are going to be, I think, the only way that the sustainability side is really going to take hold is when we care enough about it as a government, as entities, as corporations to, you know, put our money where our mouth is and either have direct savings for showing that carbon savings. And therefore, we'll have to measure it and prove that. And so it'll all kind of, just come together in that digital multiplier.
Even the low hanging fruit though, is if you can find ways, if it's less material, you know, if it's lower carbon or lower cost, you're going to generally get lower carbon with a lot of the decisions you make. So if there's ways to, you know, better optimize, make sense. And, you know, one to me, you know, as a young engineer, you're trained up though, thinking about how do you best rationalize your designs to minimize cost, right? And you're trained that material in the modern world is only like 30% of the cost, right? 70% is, you know, installation, fabrication, that's like on the steel side, right? And it's probably similar for concrete. But when you think about it, you know, carbon, it's the complete opposite. So material is 90% and fabrication erection of what we're measuring today is only like 10%. So that narrative of how do you optimize to carbon is different than cost. So and that's when you're walking under the broken bridge, right? And you see all the lattice structures and the individual pieces. This is like how we need to design to carbon today is like designing buildings 150, 200 years ago. Labor was cheap. Fabrication was, material was that 90%, right? And that's why you see the structures like you did, you know, as they exist. So that's a different mindset. We have to shift that mindset and we have to have, you know, instructive conversations with clients about what are your goals for your project. So
That's a wild thing to think about, how much of this is continually shifting and is pretty much the exact opposite of when it all started. I mean, yep. You know, you used to throw labor at every problem and we don't have that anymore. And it's not what we're focused on as much anymore either. So I'm really interested though, because we only have a few more minutes left and I know that you're at QNEC are not done moving up the chain. So you have a little something coming. So give the listeners a little, because I know, you know, we got Tekla listeners out there, not as many as you construction brothers out there, although I'm coming for you. I'm coming for you, Tyler. I love Tyler. But we got a lot of other users out there that I think would be interested in what you guys have coming next.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with our existing technology, which is, you know, integrated on top of Tekla structures, yeah, we continue to make, you know, advancements on, you know, automating different connection types, whether that's, you know, comb splices to more bracing connection types. And the more we can automate, the more time we free up, you know, for teams. But what we see for moving upstream is, or moving upstream is integrating with Revit. And so what we released, we had a soft announcement at Autodesk University last fall that we'll be rolling out this summer, and it's a QNEC for Revit. And what it is it's a QAQC tool that helps engineers make Revit models more constructible. So what it does is it audits the Revit model and with hundreds of these checks that call like expert systems that we've developed over, you know, the life of QNEC, and the creators of QNEC have decades of experience in steel detailing and fabrication and engineering, right? So this knowledge that's built into our expert system is so powerful. It helps engineers identify all the constructability issues, connection engineering issues, model integrity issues. How many Revit models have work points, you know, not at the center line of the column, or the bracing is not at the, you know, half the depth of the work point, you know, where it needs to be from an engineering standpoint. Or so it's when we've introduced this to engineers, we're kind of in beta mode right now. The engineers love it because it's helping them, you know, kind of audit the model discipline of the Revit model, but also auditing all these like constructability and engineering issues. And so the end goal is, I mean, general contractors should like it. Fabricators would probably in the future feel more willing to receive a Revit model to bid if they get these models that are just more accurate and more constructible. So, yeah, so we're right in the beta mode right now. We're excited about, you know, the direction we're going. And QNEC, you know, our background, we're cloud-based, right? So this will be, you know, one of the first kind of cloud engineering, you know, add-ons for Revit, you know, that will be, you know, automating a lot of tasks. So I'm excited about where we're going with this.
Man, I mean, I love it. Anytime we're taking native, you know, files and you know, able to kind of build on top of it as opposed to recreating from scratch, you know, that makes me happy. And yeah, it's just, yeah, continuing to move upstream and QA those models and take advantage of all that great data that's in there. So I love everything you're doing.
Yeah, it was really cool. It reminds me of some of the conversations we had at AC Integration, just around, you know, so much rework, so much non-constructible modeling being done. You know, I'll be honest, you know me, I don't know all of that talk at the center lines, et cetera, but sitting and listening enough, I get that if it's off, it throws everything off. It's like, if it's not centered in reality, it's not centered in the model, it's not going to work. So This is great to see.
Jeff, I think after all these years, you're an honorary BIM guy now.
Yeah.
I think you can, I'm now knighting you as an honorary BIM guy. You can speak it well enough at least.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's my job, sitting here talking to you BIM guys and VDC folks for long enough. Yeah, it better have rubbed off by now, right?
Yeah. Just don't leave us by ourselves. We'll go on for days.
That's why I'm at the microphone. So I'm interested. Any other final thoughts, Michael, on just, you know, you guys are moving upstream, making things constructible, which is, I mean, I love QAQC, right? If we can QAQC digitally, then we can do all those things you're talking about. Increase schedule, reduce rework. I mean, you hit this wonderful crescendo with our owners too, because, you know, having spent a lot of time over the last few years with our owners, predictability, certainty, trust, and cost and schedule, you know, reduction. I mean, you're right up their alley. What else, or what are you focused on just yourself and watching for the next couple of years in construction tech?
Yeah. So I think, well, the next step where we're going beyond, you know, the constructability review is kind of the first stepping stone, but is bringing the cost, carbon, and analytics into Revit as well, because then you're marrying all those aspects together, not just generating more constructible designs, but ones that are carbon friendly, and having that realistic balance with, you know, cost and carbon. And then third, I would say, is this layer of artificial intelligence, but still respecting, you know, there's some traditional methods of AI using, modeling off of Mother Nature, how nature evolves designs, right? Evolutionary computation. A lot of the buzz around AI is machine learning and these experience-based learning models. But when you think about that, the most, the way Mother Nature works in a lot of traditional AI systems is using genetic algorithms and some of these evolutionary methods. I think marrying both together, both experience and this, mutation-based approach of innovation, of solving problems, this is the power of where AI needs to head. I think right now there's kind of just a lot of focus on machine learning, but I think there's other existing algorithms that we need to marry together to have the ultimate expert systems to help the construction industry. So that's really the direction we're going, and we hope other people will join us. So,
wow, that was a powerful finish. I'm going to say that's the mic drop moment. We're going to leave it right there. Michael, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find more about you and more about Connect?
I would say just reach out to myself on LinkedIn, and I can connect you to all the right folks at Connect. We're just open to conversations and having a dialogue. We appreciate coming and meeting customers firsthand, or, you know, attending conferences, and yeah, we can connect anywhere these days. So look forward to the opportunity.
I love it. Well, I'm sure you're going to get a lot of connects from this one, pun intended. With that, let's head into the construction technology news of the week. Jonathan, you brought something interesting, a little outside of the industry, bringing in. What do you got?
Yeah, I mean, it's Microsoft Build. I mean, Microsoft Build 2024 just happened. And they always have some interesting announcements. And the thing about Microsoft is, a huge amount of the construction world is still sitting on PCs running Windows. We are going to see most of what they're saying at a hands-on level. So I put up an article that kind of went over the high points and wanted to talk about some of them. The biggest one for me is everybody's doing their AI dance of how what type of AI, what flavor, where's it going to be? Is it going to be this? And what they decided to do is to really put their effort, and Apple's doing something similar, behind the local AI agent. That is this AI agent that is local to your hardware, which is only possible because of some of the sort of speeding up of some of the, they have Snapdragon, which can now run language models locally and run some of the AI locally. So they're going to give you some agents, and for their display, they had it helping you out on things like video games. You're stuck in a video game and you tell your AI agent, hey, I'm stuck. It takes a little screen grab, absorbs that, and then gives you some feedback. The area where I thought it was interesting and where I think Microsoft may be making the mistake that Apple sort of made when they crushed a bunch of instruments to introduce their iPad and then immediately took down the commercial, is there's still a lot of anxiety around the surveillance and sort of the loss of privacy that AI could, if used incorrectly, cause. So I think, while these personal agents seem really cool, I think the fact that now they're going to be kind of pushed a little bit in is likely to cause some pushback. I know that I personally will probably end up using it, because I use all of the little personal agents to help my life go a little bit faster. But I also am fully understand that I might lose my privacy as a result of that. So I am very cautious about what I put in front of it. Did you get a chance to read it, Jeff? What do you think about having an AI agent that can look over your shoulder and see what you're doing on your computer?
Well, I'm a little bit worried on that side of things as well, but also just came off speaking to a bunch of contractors about, you know, the power and possibilities and just the ability to speed up what we're doing on a day-to-day basis and get through the junk of our lives to get to the things you need to do. And, you know, as an independent contractor now, I can't tell you how many times I'm quote unquote apologizing to somebody because I lost their email amongst the millions of emails that I get, where I can see this helping me and where Copilot can do those things to help me. I also, what I think it just goes, it's like a blip in there, the mini multimodal, this whole idea of multimodal is the far reaching impacts of this. Like, I was kind of having this conversation and I hope my son's school doesn't listen to this, but like, this basically means that like any test question that has a picture and something else can be consumed on a phone to give you an answer. Like the challenge and the possibilities, I don't know which side I want to go on. I don't know if I want to freak out or celebrate. I think more celebrate, because access to information and being able to parse that information and make something out of it really fast is fantastic. It's not saying it's doing anything with it, right? You're going to have to still do the things with it. It's all about getting through the mundane parts, John, but you just cringed. So a few of you cringed.
Well, have you seen the
Nathan,
Gemini?
You're cringeworthy first.
Question. If you guys have seen the Gemini, so the Google Gemini commercial, there's a little section in it where the lady's going up the elevator and she's got like all these emails and it's like, did you want me to summarize these emails for you? And it like bullet points out like the highlights of, I'm like, oh my God, that would be amazing. I mean, I also know like how hard that would be because it's, you know, I get a bunch of garbage emails that would probably try and summarize and it wouldn't know how to do it right. But I've always been a fan conceptually of what's possible there. And I think that just comes back to sort of like a human, just where do you stand? And speaking of Freakonomics, I think Jeff, we were talking about this other, episode with, Fareed Zakaria, who's an amazing geopolitical journalist, but he sort of argues that this whole, you know, political argument of left versus right and like the history of where it came from in Britain and literally like where they would argue in the left side and the right side and where we got today, and that really it doesn't apply anymore, and that really what we should be looking at is open versus closed. And that there are just people in general, and generally most IT managers, CIO kind of have more of that tendency to be closed, they know the threats of cybersecurity and everything else, so they lean towards that tendency. And those that are younger, more naive, whatever, tend to be more open. But that's also, you know, that's not a hard and fast rule. But I really like that concept now of just, you know, putting people in a box of like, it's not a left or a right thing, it's an open versus a closed thing.
I like the change there. Travis, you've been quiet. I'm going to throw it to you here. But before I do, there is one connection between some of these articles about where acquisitions have come from that have gotten better. Microsoft bought GitHub. And in this, File Explorer can be part of a Git repository. So, and also it gave them access to the developer tools, the Azure developer tools and Microsoft development tools to GitHub. So there's a little example of maybe, you know, the power of acquisition getting better. But Travis, you've been quiet. What are you holding back on there? What are you thinking, my man?
I'm not really holding back. I chuckled a little bit when I saw the article because I actually purposely try to not find an AI article to share for news. And I think that just shows us where we're at in the hype cycle. It was very, very difficult to find an article, a newsworthy article that didn't include AI implicitly. What I was pondering on while you guys were going through, especially with the privacy concerns, is I think, and Nathan, you touched on this when you were talking about open versus closed. I wonder if it's a generational thing. We're all of a certain generation. Nathan, you're kind of on the the younger or younger end of our generation or the older end of yours. But I think that especially if you talk to people, you know, in their 20s, they've never had privacy. So I kind of think that they've already taken it for granted that this thing is just going to consume all of their data. And why should I even care? Why should I worry about it? I think they should. I think that there should be some healthy concern in there. But I do tend to be more the techno optimist. And then I was thinking about the school question, and sometimes I think to myself, maybe we're doing school wrong. We're trying to make them recite and learn and memorize all of these details and formulas. And I mean, who really? How many times do you, Jonathan, during your day, use the Pythagorean theorem, but you have it memorized, right? I mean, why is that something that we need to still, you know, more, for lack of a better word, beat into our kids? You know, there are some ways we could maybe change the way we think about education if we allow the use of these tools. Now, I do agree that they still need to produce the work on their own, but maybe they learn to search, read, critically think about whatever it is that's presented to them.
No, I agree. Teaching critical thinking more than memorization, definitely. But I think knowing why Pythagorean theorem exists, like there is still something to that, like doing
there's
it once.
There, right.
But memorization is a little, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you there. And I think part of that, yeah, is like storytelling and whatnot as well. It's like, you can go find me these facts, but tell me why these things in history happened, or, you know, why we had to come to these conclusions and what they help us do as a society, you know, for whatever reason. I think it's a cool challenge. So, but I agree with you of a lot more of the critical thinking and our education system is one of those has been behind, but opportunity, right? But also scary, you know, it is. Well, I am going to take us on to the next one. And this is, I get hung up on these new things and I have to dig into them and I love them. And this one comes from my friends at QuickBase. This is called gray work. I am in love with this term. You guys have probably heard it. You've probably seen it in things I've written recently. But QuickBase invented this term, I think 2 years ago. And this is the gray work index. And I'll give you guys some of the, so what they did, and this is what I love about this is QuickBase is outside of our industry and inside of our industry. They build things for construction, but they build things for manufacturing, retail, number of other different verticals. And so they surveyed all their verticals and 54% of respondents say it's harder than ever to be productive in day-to-day work. And that's not just us, that's everybody. But on top of that, 66% said their companies are increasing their investment in technology. There's two more things, and then I'm going to let you guys kind of run with this because, and I'll explain what gray work is. 58% of respondents spend less than 20 hours per week on meaningful work that drives results. The rest of the time is spent doing non-value add tasks, mainly trying to find information, trying to get to the data that it is that they need to get things done. And here's the last one that got me is only 10% of respondents claim to be extremely confident in the accuracy of key project information, meaning 90% had some level of doubt in the accuracy of the information at hand. And doubt is one of the worst things we can have when it comes to data. I do want to give you what is gray work. Gray work, in their definition, it's pretty loose, but it's all of the Excel spreadsheets, Word documents, PowerPoints, or pick your version of Google of those if you want, that are created out of the necessity because somebody can't get something done in one of the platforms that they've provided. The reason behind that can be argued, but it is literally all of these one-off spreadsheets, et cetera, that we have across the board that we spend far too much time isolating data in and really, you know, causing some of the other things you're hearing in there. Why are we not confident in our data? Well, because I'm pretty sure a project manager has their whole own spreadsheet running with all the tasks that need to be done, or, you know, or has, you know, for this project has an RFI Excel spreadsheet or whatever. And it's interesting. I was listening to a couple of the follow-up kind of talks about it. And one of the cool things I heard was they said, it's actually a product of people wanting to do great work and knowing they need to keep good data but just not having the tool system and a frictionless system in which to store it. So what do? We do the thing we know best. And man, I know it's not me, but I'm pretty sure quite a few of you guys can whip up an Excel spreadsheet in real short time and make it do what you need it to do. So well, Travis, you're ready to go on this one.
I was going to say, that's what I was going to jump on, was the Excel part. And I think to your trust and in being sure of the data, a lot of it is, I want to see things the way I want to see them. And Excel gives me that flexibility where I can take a lot of data, you know, obviously mostly tabular data, but I can at least dump it into somewhere where I can massage and see the data that I want to see before I can then go ahead and produce the report that I need, that the actual work that I need or the deliverable that I need to produce. I do think that's a big component of it. And you know, we talked a lot in our technology in the construction industry, how, you know, especially years ago when you're just forced to do all of your RFIs and submittals in an ERP system that was very big and clunky. I mean, those remnants, I think that there's still a lot of PTSD left for a lot of our workforce that's why they still kind of cling to that stuff. What about Jonathan? You sighed there.
I think it comes down to like restrictive versus creative solutions. So like, I talk a lot about like a wicked program being like Excel, where you can do just about anything in it. But it wasn't really made to be a time card. So a time card program, if you're going to roll it out to, you know, 1,000 people, you want it to just be a time card program, but it's restrictive. They're not going to be able to do anything extra. And, you know, when you're at McDonald's and the guy says he can't give you change, because he can't figure out how to give you change. This is sort of the far side of that. We are too specialized and restrictive for the tasks we're trying to do. So it's finding a balance with that gray work between what is going to be too restrictive for the task and what is going to be scalable, that I think is very difficult to determine. And I mean, you see a lot of jokes about overly restrictive. I don't know if you guys ever saw Idiocracy and they're at the hospital and they're on the punch board punching in headache, leg ache, you know, and they've whittled down all of human suffering into 15 buttons on a screen. That's what often happens with these, is we take all of the nuance that is actually there, the reality of the tasks, and we remove it, and you end up with people that do feel productive, sort of, but are restricted in what they can actually do. I was actually really interested in that we feel productive, because productivity is kind of that is a changing definition, you know, mm-hmm. Like, yes. What was productive 10 years ago is considered a slacker today. You know, we really are in a mindset where productivity is one of the top virtues, and productivity means fast productivity too, often. So I actually had expected more. I mean, 54%, that's almost a 50-50 split, right? It's almost half the room saying, nah, I'm productive. And the other half saying, nah, not enough.
I still just feel like with all that investment, that's still a pretty low number to feel like you're being really, really productive. So, but again, it's definitional too. So, you know, I'll give you that one on that. Nathan, you're ready to go. You got that look.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember a long time ago that, you know, that's normal stats that you would spend more than half your day, you know, just looking for information. And even again, I don't know if either you guys in your time in the trade world would ever actually track tool time, which is rarely something that gets tracked. But when you do, you usually find that out in the field, you're actually spending less than half of your time actually being productive. You're either looking for information or you know, measuring things or doing other things or aren't actually moving forward on the direct task. So I think part of this is like, it's always been there. It's just, we've never been so cognizant of it before. But yet we need to be cognizant of it if we're going to put a value to that and offset whatever the cost is of the software that's going to fix it, right? So I think, you know, overall, these articles, I love this stuff. This is like the, you know, the data porn for me, because, you know, it's really justifying that need to invest in interoperability, invest in more platforms. But that's only half the battle. Like, you still have to figure out what is the best process of doing those handoffs, and how do you, you know, train up your workforce to work within those systems in a way that's both flexible to their needs, but also gets you that kind of standard report out. It is not easy, but it's a fun battle for us to try and solve.
Well, it's a great battle. I'm interested too, because you know, like part of this too is it's a product of friction. So when somebody is using a new application and they find friction, right? So that can be solved with training, right? First and foremost. But we all say this, and I think all of us have had this conversation, like there's no one real solution that hits 100% of what you need, right? It's usually about 80%. So this is also the opportunity to be transparent with yourself and say like, okay, it's capturing that. You're being forced to build this spreadsheet. Okay, but I need that data, right? Like how is that going to impact, you know, if I'm the superintendent on the project and I'm going to be passing this off for closeout, how does that affect the person I'm going to close it out to? Well, I'm going to hand them this janky spreadsheet that they've got to figure out that, yeah, it works for me, but so is there an opportunity to say, okay, this happened naturally. Let's take on and build something that solves that, that doesn't isolate that data. Whatever that might be, or however you might go about that, it's an opportunity to open it up. Because one of the other things I just was talking to somebody about this with, to bring it back to AI, is like, how interesting is it if you only have data from certain portions of your company and not all of your company? How poorly can a model expand out on where you can go and guide you in the wrong direction? A little thing we're going to have, I'm going to have somebody on from a much larger organization with a much bigger view of AI way outside of our world. And just sitting down with him for a half an hour, he asked me a bunch of questions and posed a bunch of things to me that I was like, I got to bring you on the show. Because this data problem, this data fidelity inside of your organization, and what did he call it? It's data diversity, right? That covers all of the parts of your business, is so powerful to automation and AI and machine learning in the future. It's such a core foundational issue. So, John, you look like you're going,
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm dealing a lot with data right now that was digitized. It was a non-digital company that became digital. All right. So when that happens, the data that's made is made in a bulk, at speed. So there's a lot of problems with that. And as you're starting to use it, you confront those problems because data is very unforgiving in certain aspects. And I think that, you know, we're driving towards using data, we're driving towards automation, we're driving towards all those things to make everybody more productive, more hours each day. And I keep running back into what Ryan Hoggett said up at FAB. And he's like, my welder is at 100% productivity. He is not right near everything because he needs to walk over and grab something over there because he needs that time walking or he will go nuts. And every time I see the productivity stuff that is really around tech, I'm like, exactly how much of your day can you be productive without going nuts? Are our burnout levels going up really fast as we start to implement all this? And that doesn't mean that there's causation there. It just means there's a correlation right now between burnout and technology that I think should be investigated. Because I do think that time around the water cooler is productive time. Time walking to get your stuff is productive time. Time literally building that Excel form that you wanted to build and then send out as a time card. You're building a prototype. You're doing the creative work. You're building through some of those problems. I hope that in our sort of rush to get data online, we remain sort of true to some of these early ways of building things. Because like Nathan said, you don't need to know Pythagorean theorem in your head, but you do need to know how it works. Like, why does it work? How does it work? What's the mechanics of it? Like, all of that piece of education needs to be there. And if we're giving people quick, easy answers, doesn't have an awesome track record either.
a whole nother can there, but you are absolutely right. And there is value in learning. There is value in the process. So we shouldn't be usurping that. But I love that you said, you know, Excel is great at, right? Is going through that iteration, that creation, and understanding it, but realizing it's not enterprise. You can't roll it out to 1,000 people. It's not going to work well. Okay, what tool can I then put this in that can then do those things at scale that I want, that's a great process. So you nailed it. I think the four of us could go on forever. I don't think this is the last time we're going to do it. I think we need to do this more in the future. Mm-hmm. Man, is this fun. So thank you, Travis. Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks, Nathan, for bringing your news, giving me your time, and talking to the Contech crew people out there. Thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with Michael Gustafson. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to the show, visit thecontechcrew.com. This is the Contech Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.